Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I will be your host today on this very special occasion. We don't usually broadcast on this day at this hour, but Alan Phillips, co-host to Vaccinations and Your Rights, has made special arrangements for a guest, Meryl Dorey, to be with us at some point in the show today. It is May 22nd, 2012. We are hoping to learn how to be strong, to fight the foes, to stand up for our rights and for our freedoms, and to learn from those across oceans who have won small and large battles and have kept the faith. I want to thank everybody who is tuning in. I did not send out any messages and announcements, but we will be rebroadcasting this particular show later in the week. So, hello, Alan.
Good morning, Debbie. Pleasure to be with you, as always.
Good morning. And I had a little quote because I love them so much. This is by Charles Caleb Colton, who says, "True friendship is like sound health. The value of it is seldom known until it be lost." And therefore, when we're going under tough times and challenges, who is going to stick by us and support us and be there for us to lean on and ask for help when we need it? And that's probably, you know, like our backbone, like our own energy. Who is going to be there and help us through these times? And that's why I think Charles must have really felt that in his own life, that at some point somebody was there for him, and it does help you like have good health. And that's what our show is always about, health, freedom, and good health. So we're asking folks to participate in our live broadcast. These are free educational broadcasts creating waves of awareness, and you can be part of these educational programs simply by telling your friends to listen to the show, send them an email with a link, go ahead on Twitter and post a tweet. There's a button there on the show page for you to do that. You can also click that Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace. Wow, social networking has gone wild. Oh, I almost forgot LinkedIn. You could spend all day clicking the social network buttons. And you want to favorite the show and put a reminder on. So we're going to start. Do you want me to talk about Meryl just to get started and wait for her to come in? Or do you want to talk about some other issue to begin?
Well, let's go ahead with a little bit of background. I mean, one of the beautiful things I love about the work you've done, Debbie, with Homeopathy World Community is that it is, in fact, a world community, not only a world community that is there sort of inherently or by default, but that you have proactively set out to and successfully set up a growing international network of people around the world with concerns about and related to homeopathy. And with this show in particular, with vaccine issues, while we focus on primarily on legal issues here in the U.S., the vaccine issue is very, very clearly an international issue. And there are, of course, different countries have different legal systems and different issues regarding vaccination as to whether or not they have mandates and how you handle mandates and so forth. So those particulars will vary from country to country. But the underlying issues are very similar throughout the world. And so and we talk from time to time about what's going on in other countries. I think it's really helpful for folks to have a little bit of the world view, even if the legal issues may be unique to specific locations by political or other boundaries. And
right,
so,
because, you know, as you're constantly teaching me a lot of legalese, maybe I'll call it, and you talk about precedents all the time, that what one state does, then another state follows, or what the federal government does, then the states use as some sort of a precedent for their decision-making policy. And in the same way, we can think of that in a broader, more expansive way as what one country does, another country might view that point of view and see what the population or the officials are doing and then copy that and use that as a legal precedent. Would you say that's true?
Well, it is, and we use the word precedent sometimes with different meanings. In law, it has a very specific meaning in terms of the concept you were talking about where a particular court makes a decision, and in certain contexts and situations, those decisions can be written in the U.S. in what's called a published opinion that then serves as legal precedent for that court's jurisdiction. And in some cases, other courts around the country may follow that as well. And so it has a formal legal sense, but we also talk about precedent in a more general, non-formal sense in terms of behaviors and actions, you know, not in the sense of does a court have to follow this precedent. You know, a precedent comes from court cases, will be about a decision about a certain set of facts and the way a law or laws apply to those facts, and it serves as a reference point in the law for similar or analogous system, situations in the future. But we also talk about precedent in much more general terms, what people do, their behavior, and does someone's actions or inactions serve as a model in a less formal sense that others may follow as well, and that can have a lot of relevance, of course, in a lot of different situations. But here in this arena, so we looked, for example, if a particular state enacts a certain kind of law, other states may follow that example and say, "Oh, they enacted that law there. Let's do that here." That's not formal legal precedent in the sense that a legislature in any way is bound by what some other legislature has done. But on a practical level, that's often what happens. So
Yes, that's what I meant, that each of us in the world are looking at one or the other. And we take our cues from each other to what is a popular stance or what we feel is the correct answer to a problem or how to handle a problem that might be controversial and what stand should we take upon it, you know, whether it is taking action early or waiting to make a decision. And when we see somebody actually put down a law or take a stand, then it's going to turn heads for us to look that way. And it looks like we have our guest. Okay.
We have to give
her a formal. Oh, here's my. I didn't have my mic in front of my face here. Maybe I'll have some. Maybe I'll have some better sound instead of listening to the top of my head. Meryl, we're going to welcome you this morning, and it's at Wednesday evening for you. Or
it's actually Tuesday evening.
Okay. It's Tuesday evening for you. It's Tuesday very early in the morning for us. And we did not give you a formal introduction yet because we were just chatting and getting started here. So we would like to say, Meryl Dorey, you are the spokesperson. Are you also the president of the Australian Vaccination Network?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and the editor of the Living Wisdom magazine for Family Health and the Environment, calling in from Australia. And if anybody wants to visit the website, it is www.avn.org.au, and the magazine is www.living-wisdom.com. And Meryl has a tagline on her emails I thought would be appropriate, by C. Wright Mills: freedom is not merely the opportunity to do as one pleases. Neither is it merely the opportunity to choose between set alternatives. Freedom is, first of all, the chance to formulate the available choices, to argue over them, and then the opportunity to choose. And she also goes for, yay, Gloria Steinem, another freedom fighter. The authority of any governing institution must stop at its citizens' skin. Wow. So that's a pretty powerful short line. And maybe you'll get into exactly how you chose these as your taglines that people are going to read every time they bump into you on the email.
Well, I don't really remember how I found them, but I am wonderful at stealing things that I really like. So I probably saw them in someone else's email and borrowed them. And I just think that they're so appropriate for the Australian Vaccination stands for what we do.
Okay, well, since this is the first time we're calling in this way, I might request, if our sound keeps being choppy and cutting in and out, I might request for you to sign out and sign in again, but we'll continue on like this and see how it goes. Are our voices clear to you?
Yes, I can hear you fine, so it may be my end. The dedication is now what to do.
Yeah, I don't know, because you may have a slow internet connection, which is going to make it a little bit choppy that way. And it's always wise when anybody out there who's listening and you're on the internet and you're trying to get a good sound, it's always good to turn off, close all your other programs, whether you've got your email, your calendar, whatever else you've got open, extra browser windows, close all of those and open up just the ones that you're working, to devote all of your computer energy to one thing.
I'm doing that right now.
Okay, good idea, and I'm doing it myself. Okay, closing all these little windows.
Well, Meryl, I'd love to give you a special welcome as well. Meryl and I have been in contact off and on over some period of years. I don't even remember when we first connected, and I believe we even met in person in at least one occasion. And as Debbie and I were just discussing a few moments ago before you joined us, the vaccine issue, of course, is very much an international issue, although certainly various aspects of the issue are localized to individual countries or even individual regions or states or cities or what have you. And so I'm delighted to have the opportunity to focus on Australia for a little while here and get some clarity myself on what's been going on there. I know I'm on your email list and I get your regular updates, but it's hard to find the time to really keep up with everything. And so just really glad to have you here and have the opportunity to focus on what's going on with you and AVN and Australia.
Well, thanks, Alan. I really appreciate the chance to talk about this issue. And like you said, different countries have different regulations, but quite often what starts in one place ends up going to the other. So it's important for people to be aware what's happening around the world, especially when it comes to issues of health rights, because we have such, you know, globalization going on, that what happens in Australia will happen in the U.S. and vice versa.
So, very good point there, because we were actually just a few minutes ago talking about how that happens here within the U.S., that many times what one state legislature does in terms of the kind of law they enact, other states will say, well, hey, they got one of those. Let's put one of those laws here in this state. Do you see that don't mean to put you on the spot here, but do you have any particular examples that come to mind of something you've seen happen either in another country and then Australia followed, or vice versa, something that went on in Australia that you then saw go somewhere else?
Well, there's an expression in Australia that when the United States is down, Australia goes.
She's gonna have to repeat that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like me to now put it in again, or?
Debbie, do you think we should ask?
Are you able to?
Should we ask her to try reconnecting again, Debbie?
Just sign yourself out and then sign yourself in again.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay.
And while she's doing that, we'll say Meryl is the founder of the Australian Vaccination Network, and of course we'll get her back in a moment and ask her to explain in a little more detail, but this is something that she founded back in 1994, so she's been at this then for the better part of 18 or so years, I guess, or 16, get my math together here. But
wow, she's held in there a long time. Yep.
So
she sent us a special article this morning, which is going to be pertinent. It's going to send waves around the world in regard to homeopathy. I think that homeopathy is a pretty solid foundation of form of medicine. It's been practiced by millions of people around the world and hundreds of thousands of homeopathic physicians in India. Today, the data keeps coming out everywhere with lots of studies about the efficacy of homeopathy, that it truly does work. We have many national and international conferences with Nobel Prize laureates and scientists and physicians who are speaking up that homeopathy can do so much for contagious, endemic, infectious disease, and for acute and chronic illness, and we see that every day in our practices. And so here she shows us that there's a article on transformingthenation.com in Australia.au. That's someone is trying to take down homeopathy. It's a legal challenge, so I'm wondering how this is going to play out. There's a gentleman named Bruce Arnold, lecturer in law at the University of Canberra, investigates the clinical effectiveness of homeopathy. And, you know, we could think about all the different things, all the kinds of alternative medicine. Let's check. I'm going to check to see if she signed in again. Yeah, she's here. I'm sorry. I was going on and talking about this article that you sent me, and I put you on pause. So thank you for taking note of it and pointing it in our direction.
No problem. It's quite a frightening thing that's happening in Australia, and I don't know if the same sort of thing is happening in the U.S., but there are very strong moves to try and outlaw any form of natural medicine. Homeopathy probably the number one target, and you know, but chiropractic, osteopathy, Chinese medicine, all of these are considered to be not evidence-based, according to the Western mainstream medical practitioners, and there is a very strong move to make sure that people will not be able to study these arts, healing arts in universities. and that health consumers won't have access to the remedies and treatments of natural therapists. And it's something that Australians are up in arms about, and hopefully we'll be able to avoid the restriction that people who benefit from are the pharmaceutical companies and the medical community.
Wouldn't you consider this almost like out and out censorship, as if you were burning books? That it's it. I feel this way about it. If it's something that is trying to be closed off and eliminated, where it's being used today, these works are being read and studied and practiced, and medicines are being proven all the time. So the fact that it could be limited, especially to the medical profession.
Yes, it is very much a long line of censorship, and one thing the United States has in its favor, that Australia does not have the Bill of Rights. And it's something that we honestly quite important here, because we don't have protections of the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. We have in the United States, so we don't have enshrined constitutional law, freedom of speech or freedom of communication. There have been court cases that have said that we have things challenged on a regular basis. And as a matter of fact, just recently, we have received notification from the Therapeutic Goods Administration. The Australian Vaccination Network. Which I sell both DVDs and all the vaccination. And one of the DVDs is called Answer to Cancer. It's a DVD called Vaccine, which has been used, I understand, for thousands of years as a topical treatment to get rid of cancer. And this DVD is simply a series of testimonials from people who have used success. Also give instructions on how to make black salve yourself. And the Therapeutic Goods Administration, which is the equivalent of the administration, has admitted that we remove the DVD from our website.
Meryl, I'm going to pause you for a moment. This is our first... Are you able to hear me?
I hear you fine.
Okay, this is our first experiment calling in to you from, you're calling in from Australia, we're calling in from the East Coast of the United States, and because of the internet and communication waves, the sound that's coming in from you is, I feel like I'm jumping rope, that I just, I feel like
I... Can I call you on the phone? Can I call you
on the
phone?
Yeah, you want to try that and see if it will work?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so she's going to sign out for a moment. And you know, Alan, I was thinking, you know, this must be what it feels like when you're during World War II or something, where you're trying to tune into a channel and get a sound through a communication channel and hear from behind the lines. You know, or watching a television show that's not coming in as all static, and you get half of every word, but I guess eventually you learn to understand and decode what's being said. It sounded like she was talking about black salve, and that is something that is used to heal cancer, and it's and also being squashed, and the information on the internet is being closed down?
Well, it's not surprising, but of course disturbing to hear that the parallels between the U.S. and Australia, that we certainly see efforts here to suppress access to any sort of alternative and complementary vitamins and supplements and so forth. There's constantly a constant effort. And I guess the thing that's so most disturbing to me, or one of the most disturbing things to me about this on a conceptual level, is that what we're fighting against our own government, and that is happening because of the industry control of government. It's not really, on its most fundamental level, at least I don't feel that it is, a people versus the government sort of issue, but it becomes that when the Federal Trade Commission or the FDA or the CDC are in effect promoting, just outright promoting the pharmaceutical solution and countering, working against, attempting to suppress any other sort of approach. And I'll tell you, just from a personal point of view, and I'm sure, Debbie, you would at least generally agree with this as well, but from a personal point of view, in my own exploration for myself and my family of conventional and alternative and complementary medical care, I'm of the impression that true healing is most likely to occur in most situations if you're outside of the allopathic model. It feels like the allopathic model, regardless of its original intentions, which I feel was probably to otherwise, nonetheless has ended up being directed at sustaining and treating and perhaps even causing, by way of vaccines and other procedures, medical problems. Let's, you know, increase the market size and maximize profits. I mean, let's face it, medicine as a business has implicitly as its goal to of maximizing profits to cause people to be sick or to find ways to treat something over time without actually healing or curing it, because there goes another income stream. And whether that and to what extent that is something that is a deliberate conscious effort is certainly subject to debate, but we look at what's actually playing out in the world, and it's almost like it doesn't matter whether it is or not, it might as well be, because the effect of what we see going on in the world is the same as if it were.
Well, she has called in. Meryl?
Hi there. Is this any better?
A whole lot better so far. I hope it
holds
up.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's keep our fingers crossed.
All righty. Okay,
well,
go ahead, and you guys get started with the conversation, and I will sit back and listen. I'll pop in just from here and here and there to say a remark. Go ahead.
Well, Meryl, I'm again delighted to have you with us today. I just want to say this morning, but it's this evening for you. But tell me a little bit, please, because I'm looking forward. I've, of course, known about you and your work for a long time, but I'm looking forward to learning more about that, and I'm sure I won't be able to help myself to make comparisons and contrasts with what my understanding of what's going on in the U.S. is, as we hear you talk about what's going on with the AVN and the vaccine issue in Australia. But I think it would be safe to say, as a starting point, that there are some broad similarities in that there's a tremendous push by the pharmaceutical industry and perhaps the government in Australia as well. I'll be interested in hearing what you say about that, because here in the U.S. it seems clear to those of us in the alternative vaccine community that industry profoundly influences, if not outright exercises control over government, and we feel like we're at odds with our own government at times. But I feel like it's really industry working through or controlling government, and maybe not government on an sort of inherent fundamental level per se, but as a practical matter, yes, we're at odds with our government, which here in the U.S., of course, mandates vaccines in a couple of dozen different contexts, depending on how you count. And so we're constantly dealing with whether or not and how you can come up with an exemption or exception to those mandates. Are vaccines mandated in Australia?
Not for school children, but let's put it this way. Legally, they're not mandated for school children, but if you asked 100 parents, do they think vaccination is compulsory in order for their children to go to school, probably 95 of those parents would say, yes, it's mandatory, because the government has been so blatant about trying to make people think that it's compulsory that most people actually do. And we've just had a situation here recently. The government gives certain payments to parents There are payments that are not available in the United States, but they're parenting payments. And there is a certain payment of $728 a year that's part of your tax benefit. And the government actually came out and said in writing and also in a series of articles that unless a parent vaccinated their child fully, they wouldn't get this payment. And that's not true. And we contacted the Department of Health and said, you know, why are you saying this when it's not true? And we were told by a senior policy advisor at the Department of Health that, well, the government is trying very hard to push vaccination. They didn't use that word. They said that government supports full vaccination. And therefore, it would be, you know, wrong for them to let parents know about the exemptions that are available. So, you know, it's a very blatant attempt to mislead parents. School children don't have to be vaccinated, but anyone who works in the hospital system is required by policy but not by law to be vaccinated, and people in the military are required to be vaccinated. But, you know, as you said, I often think that Australia is not actually a democracy, it's a Scientocracy, because the policies that are written when it comes to science and medicine by the medical communities, by the AMA, which is nothing more than a medical lobby group, and by the drug companies themselves, the committees like ATAGI, the Australian Technical Advisory Group for Immunization, which is the government group that actually decides which vaccines we're going to use and when they should be given. They have what they call stakeholders on this committee, and the stakeholders consist of representatives of the medical community and representatives of the pharmaceutical companies, as well as government health officials. There are not real consumer stakeholders on there, and yet it is the consumer who is the end user of these vaccines and should be represented when the government is making policy.
Well, we have a real similar thing here in the U.S. The couple of federal agencies, there's ACIP and I think another group whose acronym I don't recall off the top of my head, but to make policy, issue policy, vaccine policy here in the U.S., and there are people right out of the industry on that panel. And it's sort of interesting. On one hand, you could certainly understand on a very superficial level anyway, that the quote-unquote experts on vaccination, well, certainly that would be people who are in the industry and dealing with it on a daily basis. And yet, of course, as you're pointing out, occurs so blatantly in Australia and I think here in the U.S. as well, that the representation of the true stakeholders, the true end users, the ones who really are dealing one way or another, consciously or otherwise, with the issue are inadequately represented, if they're represented at all. And I know one of the things that's so frustrating to me is that one of many things, you know, our own federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration and Centers for Disease Control, people from those agencies in recent years have acknowledged that something on the order of 90 to 99% of the vaccine adverse events are not even reported for a variety of reasons that we could go into. And so there's really no way at this point, there's no data available for anybody to calculate whether or not vaccines have any kind of net benefit. Even if we assume that vaccines work and are effective, which is a whole separate question, but even if we assume that, we have no data to compare, no adverse events data to compare to. Is there any kind of program, governmental or otherwise, in Australia that tries to track vaccine injuries? And do you have any insight into whether or not there is any sort of real tracking of that in Australia?
Our situation is very similar to that in the United States, except you actually have publicly available whatever, you know, the 1% of reactions that get reported, you can actually view them online. The Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System is available to everyone. Here in Australia, that information is covered up, and it wasn't always covered up, but now it is completely covered up. For instance, when the Gardasil vaccine was introduced in 2006, that's the vaccine for human papillomavirus, the so-called cervical cancer vaccine. In the first 12 months after the vaccine was introduced, Australia experienced a greater than 1,600% increase in the rate of reported reactions to vaccination. And our Commonwealth Department of Health bulletin, which comes out every 4 months, 3 months, sorry, actually specifically said that the increase was due to the introduction of the Gardasil vaccine. So there was an admission right there that there was a huge increase in the rate of adverse reactions due to the introduction of this one vaccine. But you cannot find out what the outcomes were about these vaccinations. What sorts of reactions were they? Were they neurological problems? Did they lead to death? Did people have seizures? You know, in the U.S. you can see what the reactions are. In Australia that information is held very close to the chest. And another difference between Australia and the U.S. is, you know, the Therapeutic Goods Administration in the U.S. is far from perfect, and there's way too much pharmaceutical influence with the Food and Drug Administration. But our TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, since 1998 has been operating under a system called cost recovery. Now, this is the government body that licenses all drugs and therapeutic goods, so vaccines as well. And what they're supposed to do is make sure that before they're licensed, they're safe and effective. But the TGA since 1998 has not received any government funding whatsoever. All of their money comes from the licensing fees paid for licensing drugs and vaccines. If they don't license them, they don't get paid. It's absolutely outrageous. And we're told that this is an ethical system, and yet they are totally dependent on the drug companies whose products they're supposed to be overseeing. But worse than that...
Can I stop you for just a moment here, because I just want to make a comment. I believe I hear what you're saying, but I can't believe what I'm hearing. And and yet, I continue to have a streak of naivete that I've had all my life, occasionally works against me, and... but it's just in the legal system here in the U.S., we have something, a principle, where if there's even the appearance of a conflict of interest, for example, with a judge, if a judge knows one of the parties or is related to one of the parties in a case or something like that, if there's even the appearance of a conflict, you know, a judge has to recuse himself or herself, which means get out of the case and get another judge in. If just the appearance. And I can't help but think, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we had that kind of a rule in the medical world? If there was even the appearance of conflict, then we have to resolve that so that everything not only is lacking conflict of interest, but, you know, also has the appearance. Because the appearance, of course, means either that there potentially is a conflict or that somebody's going to feel that the ruling, in the case of a court case, a ruling was biased, even if it really wasn't biased. And how far we could go if we could have that kind of a concept brought into our medical systems. But please go on.
Meryl, can you please repeat again that hidden agenda of what is going on so I understand it completely? You're saying drugs get to the market, and please repeat it one more time.
No problem. Our regulator, our government regulator, is called the Therapeutic Goods Administration, or the TGA, and they license all drugs and vaccines and therapeutic goods in Australia. Since 1998, they have received no funding from the government. All of their funding comes from the licensing fees that are paid when new drugs, vaccines, and therapeutic goods are registered. So if they don't register the drugs and vaccines, they have no money to operate. They are totally reliant on pharmaceutical money in order to regulate the pharmaceutical companies.
The more products and drugs that they allow to get out into the marketplace, the more income they have.
Exactly.
And it's just so blatant, but go ahead.
It is. And just like the Food and Drug Administration, there's a revolving door with the TGA. If someone works at the TGA, they're not making a fortune. They're making a good living, but they're not making, you know, a huge amount of money. But if they stay there for a few years and they do their job like a good girl or boy, then they have a great career waiting for them with the pharmaceutical companies as soon as they leave the TGA. So, you know, there's such a strong link, such an incredibly unethical link between the TGA and the pharmaceutical companies. But not only that, you know, they're supposed to license drugs and vaccines, and yet they do no testing at all. All the testing, let's say drug XYZ is being brought to market to treat diabetes. And the drug needs to show that it is both safe and effective for the treatment of people who have diabetes. But the company that makes the drug and sells the drug and profits from it actually is the same company that does all the testing. They do the tests, they present it to the Therapeutic Goods Administration. Based on the information provided by the drug company, the TGA will decide whether or not they're going to license that drug or vaccine. There's no independent oversight. It's like a tobacco company saying, we have a new cigarette that is going to make people healthy, and here is our information, we've done all the studies, and we are telling you that this cigarette is the best thing since sliced bread. Now, everyone would laugh. Everyone would say, well, of course, we can't believe them because they have a stake. They have a vested interest in wanting to make people believe this. So why people are so much more willing to listen to drug companies when they say that their products are safe and effective and when there's no oversight, I really don't understand.
Isn't most people's relationship, certainly here in the States, I think this would be true, and Debbie or Meryl both, please chime in on this, but what comes to mind is that most people's relationship to health in the allopathic health is their medical doctor, and we've been trained to trust and respect the doctors. They know all about health and how to treat it and problems and so forth, and we just sort of blindly believe the doctors, and that just sort of, I think, extends on out to everything connected with that, anything the doctor might prescribe to us, and therefore the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, do you think that's a part of that, perhaps, just this whole mentality of the doctors know it all, we know nothing, and they can do no wrong kind of mentality?
I think that for people maybe my generation and a little bit older, that's very much the case. I grew up with, you know, Doctor Knows Best, was it, I think it was called, and all of those shows, Marcus Welby, MD, where the doctor was basically infallible, and no matter what was wrong with you, the doctor could cure it. But in the younger generation, and I'm talking about, you know, the 20-somethings, 30-somethings, they still seem to have that attitude that if something goes wrong, they go straight to the doctor, and if the doctor gives them something and it doesn't help them but makes them need something else from the doctor, they just keep going back for more drugs. And I don't know when this is going to end. In the U.S., according to Gary Noe, 1 million Americans, almost every year, 1 million Americans die because of adverse reactions to properly prescribed medication, medical error, and hospital infections. That's almost 1 million people a year. How many years can this go on before people start questioning and saying, why, if we're spending one-third of our gross domestic product on drugs and vaccines, are we sicker than we've ever been before? Why do I have so many people in my family who've died at the hands of doctors? And, you know, why are my kids asthmatic, autistic? Why are they suffering from all of these conditions that when I was a kid didn't even exist?
This is a really good question. Who needs to connect the dots there? I mean, it's in our face. We live with it every day. And why aren't they not paying attention to these actual statistics and figures, which we could call more scientific? And they want evidence. They want science. And you're talking about numbers.
I think part of the medical paradigm is to disempower people. There's a secret language, like the secret handshake. You know, everybody uses, the doctors use this very technical language that, you know, the average Joe citizen wouldn't necessarily understand. And they have been disempowered for generations. thinking that they are not capable of understanding the things that are being done, and they simply have to go to the doctor, and the doctor will tell them what to do. And we see this all the time. People are taught not to take responsibility for themselves and for their children. And one of the things that I get all the time when I'm speaking on radio or to the newspapers is, well, what gives you the right to think that you can make a comment on this issue? Have you got a medical degree? As if having a medical degree suddenly gives you this amazing ability to be right all the time and to make a decision for other people. Well, that's not the case. Anyone is capable of understanding this information, but we have been so disempowered. We have been so, I'm trying to think of the right word, we've been told that we can't do it.
We
can't do it.
We've lost our own personal legitimacy. Our own affirmation of ourselves, our beliefs, what we tangibly have in our life and experience, we're saying, no, that's not true. You do not experience what you're telling us. You know, your child is not this way or that way because of we're not allowed to connect the dots.
There is. I'm going to play devil's advocate here for just a minute on this, add an element of clarity to that point, because I think that's a fundamental issue that you hit on, Meryl, that people will say, well, you're not the expert, so, you know, why would we trust you when there's somebody who's been to medical school and really knows and understands all this? And there is some validity. I mean, first of all, we are in our current society and civilization in developed nations around the world. We're in increasingly highly specialized societies, more so and more so, and it becomes more and more true within a frame of reference, and I want to elaborate on this in a moment, that people in any profession or in professions generally are increasingly specialized. You know, a real quick example, you used to see in the practice of law, general practitioners were very common, people who would handle, attorneys who would handle a wide range of different kinds of issues. And now, in recent decades and years, general practitioners are going by the wayside just because individual areas of law are becoming increasingly specialized, and even the so-called general practitioner has to really focus primarily on two or three, or maybe at most four different kinds of issues. And so there is some validity up to a point to the idea of, what do you know? You're not a medical doctor on this issue. But let me add to that what we're talking about in the vaccine controversy in terms of the general public is not really at all the finer points of medical science about the subtle inner workings of the human body at a level and in a way that you would necessarily have to have a medical degree to understand. And there, when you get down to that level, we find that medical experts disagree anyway. But a lot of, and either one of you might disagree with that comment, but here's really my main point, that what is, to me anyway, fundamental to this whole vaccine controversy is not so much the science, even though that's obviously a necessary component of it, but rather the politics. And I say to people, I mean, and they're not clear lines dividing the medicine, the politics, the legal issues, and all these different aspects. But many of the more critical and important elements here are not, the bottom line, issues that have to do and that require a medical degree and formal medical training to understand. And I think one possible answer when somebody says, well, who are you to talk about this? You're not a doctor, is to say, well, I'm talking about the politics. I'm talking about corruption. I'm talking about issues and aspects of this issue that any intelligent person who looks at it with an open mind can see for themselves. I'm not telling you to not believe the doctor and believe me. I'm telling you, look at this information for yourself, and you decide whether it's something you can understand. But don't decide ahead of time, you know, without looking at what I'm saying, that what I'm saying doesn't make sense. And I think that's a lot of what goes on. I think underneath that is a fear. People are, whether it's conscious or not, they're afraid, what if you're right? I mean, if the doctors really are wrong, what does that say about our society? And the implications, of course, they are profound.
It's very true. The cornerstone of Western medicine is the germ theory, and the proof of the germ theory is vaccination. And if vaccination is wrong, then three-quarters of what we do in Western medicine is wrong as well. And that's very challenging for anyone who has devoted their life and their career to medicine. And there are many doctors now who are learning natural therapies. We have, you know, doctors practicing homeopathy and naturopathy, doctors who are getting second degrees in chiropractic, because they feel, they can see for themselves that they are not helping patients the way that they want to help patients. And let's face it, if you're going to spend 8 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars going to school to become a doctor, you're not just doing it because you have nothing better to do with your time. You're doing it generally because you want to help people. And there are many doctors who are seeing that the writing is on the wall, that Western medicine is not able to help people as much as it should. But it's a huge challenge to see this. And there is a political aspect to this, a very big political aspect. But I have to say, Alan, after researching this for over 20 years since my own son's adverse reactions, that the average general practitioner or internist, I think you call them in America, I've been here for so long I forget what it's called, the average general practitioner or just doctor who has gone to medical school knows virtually nothing about vaccination, because almost all of the information they've gotten is first of all provided by pharmaceutical companies, or the texts are written with the assistance of pharmaceutical companies, and they don't do extra research unless this is an issue that they're really involved with. And the average parent who's read a couple of books and some articles about vaccination will generally know more, in my experience, than the average doctor would on this subject and on many other subjects like nutrition, which they don't really get much training in medical school. So I think that it's important for parents to know that this is a human rights issue and a political issue, but it is also an issue of science. And the science behind vaccination is not there. We've been using vaccines for about 230 years, and in all of that time, we've never had a study that's compared the overall health of the fully vaccinated with the fully unvaccinated. We've also never had the true double-blind, what they call randomized control trials, where you have one group who's given a vaccine and another group that's given a totally inert substance, like a saline solution or a sugar pill, and the two groups are then compared. The researchers don't know which group got which. You see which group gets sick. You see which group stays well. That is the gold standard of medical research, and it's not done for vaccines because most vaccines have been grandfathered in. There's an assumption that if a vaccine can create antibodies in your bloodstream, then the vaccine is working, and therefore it would be unethical to do a real scientific study of vaccination, because a real scientific study would leave one group unvaccinated, and we can't have that. So an assumption has been made, and you can't make assumptions like that in science. So you need to have the basic science, and parents need to know that this science does not exist.
Are our governments kind of talking out of two sides of their mouth in that respect, because they go ahead and they do medical experiments on prisoners, mm-hmm. on military personnel, on in poverty-stricken areas of the country? So they're actually doing these kinds of tests, which could be double-blinded. It is totally unethical. And when they claim that they can't do these types of things with vaccines as being unethical, as withholding medical treatment, what do you say to that?
I say that the hypocrisy is breathtaking. There are so many examples of absolutely unethical experimentation. What about that HIV vaccine trial that actually increased your risk of getting AIDS? There are trials like that going on all the time in developing countries. American pharmaceutical companies and European pharmaceutical companies are doing tests on children and adults for drugs and vaccines and killing them by the thousands every year. And this is happening in developing countries because they don't have the ethics boards and the controls that we have in developed countries. So in order to bring a drug or a vaccine to market, you've got to have these trials, no matter how poorly run they are. And so they're done in third world countries. So, you know, when we talk about ethics, drug companies and ethics are an oxymoron. It's like military intelligence or jumbo shrimp. You know, it's absolute opposites. So the whole excuse of saying that we can't test vaccines because we'd have to leave a group unprotected doesn't make any sense. Debbie, you are absolutely right with that.
And they're going further now. There have been published callings for doing experiments with vaccines and studies involving pregnant women, where you can, of course, see a very clear moral imperative not to, because you're not going to experiment with an unborn fetus and just see what happens, you know, in some that get vaccinated and some that don't. But the ethical and moral conflicts that we're discussing and that we see when you look at this as objectively as you can will disappear completely when you look at it from the perspective of how do you maximize pharmaceutical profits. And really, the deeper I dig, I know in my own, I've been looking at the issue for not quite as long as you, Meryl, but almost, about since my 18-year-old was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the deeper I dig, the messier it gets, is my shorthand for 18 years of research on the subject. But it really, it comes down almost that simple to me, that if you look at it from the perspective of maximizing pharmaceutical profits, it's all perfectly consistent and reasonable. And if you look at it from the point of view of what is something, what's the best for health and healthcare and maximizing health and well-being, that it's just full of contradictions and hypocrisy, as you say, and all kinds of conflicts. There was a New York pediatrician, Dr. Larry Pilevsky, who does talks on the vaccine issue, and he's very much aware of the problem and speaks out about the controversy. And he reports, as other medical doctors have, that there's very, and just to echo what you said, Meryl, that there's very little training on vaccines in medical school. Although he did point out that in a medical textbook, at least here in the States, that they acknowledge that the vast majority of disease decline preceded vaccines. The whole vaccine policy and law here in the U.S. and elsewhere seems to be based, as again, Meryl, as you have already said, on some fundamental errors about this notion that vaccines, for example, are what have caused disease declines in the 1900s, and it's just not what has happened when 90 to 95% of the disease decline preceded the vaccines, and in some cases, well-documented instances where vaccines have actually resulted in a reversal of pre-existing disease declines.
Well, whooping cough is a perfect example of that. Do you mind if I speak about that?
Please go. Yes.
Okay, fantastic.
Meryl, I would also like to make note that on Monday at 11 o'clock Eastern Time, Dr. Tony Bark will be on our Health In show talking about the whooping cough epidemic here in America. So just to inform our listeners that there will be another show specifically about it, but we would love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. And it is. It's a huge issue. In the United States and in Australia actually has had the biggest increase of whooping cough, and I'm calling it whooping cough. You call it whooping cough. Sorry. It's the same thing. We've had the biggest increase around the world in Australia. And we have, even though vaccination is not compulsory here, we have about 95% of all children fully vaccinated against whooping cough. We had mass vaccination start in 1953. And in 1953, our rate of whooping cough was about 180 cases per 100,000 head of population. So before there was a vaccine, we had that many cases occurring. Today, our rate of whooping cough is higher than it was before we had the vaccine on a mass basis. And the United States, in certain states, that is exactly the same. Now, we have vaccination rates in the U.S. They're, I don't know, 97-98% in children once they reach school age. Would that be about right, Alan?
The Journal of the American Medical Association published an article, I think it was back in 2004, where they said exemption rates run 1-2.5%. So that would mean that 97-98% or more of children by those figures are at least partially, if not fully, vaccinated. But we see different figures. Now, this is part of the part of the politics that has surfaced more strongly in very recent years here, because we're seeing states claiming really high exemption rates, and you have to look beneath the figures and say, well, what are you counting, and how are you defining your terms? And we had a real interesting instance of that in Vermont recently, where the state health department was claiming 5% of kids weren't vaccinated, and then somebody on the alternative side looked at the data and said, well, they were counting all the recommended vaccines, but if you look at just the vaccines that are required in Vermont, recommended by the CDC, but if you look at what's actually required in Vermont, which is something less than the total vaccine schedule recommended by the CDC, there was something like 98% compliance. And so figures, statistics are always kind of a slippery thing, even in the best of situations, meaning even when the data is most reliable. But statistics are almost always thrown around as though they are solid and, you know, concrete and something just rigid and tangible. It's really hard to get a clear answer, I guess, on the question is what I'm trying to say. But I would say that on average, the vaccination rates of fully or partially vaccinated are just way up there. As to fully vaccinated, it would be in the mid to high 90s would be my guess.
So that would be about the same as Australia, at least for the age group who are getting the whooping cough vaccine. And
right.
Since 1996, there has been an increase in the rate of whooping cough around the world. And a researcher in the Netherlands by the name of Fritz Mooy has been studying this for a long time. And what he's found is a couple of things that are very interesting that you won't hear about in the media. This is the other thing. The media has a blackout on actually covering anything from the side of informed choice. What Dr. Mooy has found is that one thing, there are two different types of bacteria that cause disease that looks and sounds exactly like whooping cough. One of them is the regular Bordetella pertussis, what we normally call whooping cough, and the other one is Bordetella parapertussis. Now, parapertussis has always been around, but before we had really easy access to laboratory testing, anyone who had those symptoms would be considered to have whooping cough. Now, the vaccines that we use do not contain parapertussis. And what Dr. Mooy was finding was that a large percentage of the cases of what we call whooping cough were being caused by this other bacteria that's not even in the vaccine. So it never would have been prevented by vaccination. But even more interesting and perhaps a bit frightening is that what's causing a lot of today's whooping cough, 86% of whooping cough in Australia is being caused by a new strain of the bacteria that actually causes much worse symptoms than the older strain of whooping cough. And this strain is not contained in the vaccine, and this is why in Australia and in the United States we're seeing babies dying from whooping cough for the first time in a very long time. So not only is the vaccine not able to prevent much of the disease that's circulating in the community because it's simply a different strain of bacteria than what's in the vaccine, but what Dr. Mooy said is that this newer, more dangerous strain of whooping cough could very well have been caused by our mass use of vaccination in much the same way that you get antibiotic resistance if you overuse antibiotics, which we do, and it causes the emergence of these super strains of bacteria. Well, overuse of the vaccine may have led to this new bacteria, which is much more dangerous, and it's not being prevented by the vaccine. Yet every time there is an outbreak and we hear about more cases of whooping cough being reported, it's always laid at the door of the unvaccinated. And I don't know if they're saying this in the United States, but in Australia now they're starting to say that vaccines only work if everyone does it. So it's a way of excusing the fact that the majority of the people who get these diseases are fully vaccinated against them. We have 75% of all children under the age of 4 who get whooping cough are fully vaccinated, and a further 14% are partially vaccinated. And in the U.S., there was a study that was just done recently that said that children between the ages of 8 and 12 who are vaccinated against whooping cough are more likely to get the disease than children who are unvaccinated.
Wow. And I know we saw something similar during the so-called pandemic, where there was Canadian researchers who were finding that if you had been vaccinated in the previous year with seasonal flu vaccine, you had twice, I think it was something like twice, the risk of getting and developing the swine flu. We saw, you know, variations and versions of the same story have played out historically. I know in polio here in the U.S. had been in a decline for about 5 years before the first vaccine was introduced. And when it was introduced, we actually saw a reversal of that decline. It was very deliberately and carefully covered up by redefining the terms so that on paper polio went down, while in fact out in the real world it was increasing dramatically for at least a couple of years after they introduced the vaccine. So it's disturbing to hear, you know, new versions of the same story over and over again, but I think it's important for us to understand that it's not new, that this is the way this particular system operates. And so, you know, again, if we can bring a light to bear on the mechanisms here, the corruption, the deliberate hiding of information or deceit and so forth, and I tell you, when I hear, as you were saying earlier, the outright, when it gets to a level of outright lies, I mean, I think the level of boldness is just so disturbing, and it's almost, you know, ironically, it's almost the best way for them to protect themselves is to do the most bold move, such as a deliberate lie for that something's required when it isn't, or you're not going to get money when that's not true, that sort of thing. It's almost the best way to hide something, because I think a good many people just don't believe that anybody would really lie like that, so they're just not even going to consider it, and it's hard to, for many people on a psychological level, to get over that hump, to realize that, yes, people really can and do operate or function or act this way, because most of us would never do that or can't imagine ourselves ever doing that. And so how could anybody else possibly do that? And I have spent years, Meryl, ignoring or, if anything, laughing at the so-called conspiracy theories and just again, I think for me and for many people, there's just this barrier. If you, and I avoid sweeping general terms or sensationalism, and yet I find myself in more recent months steering back to some of those more sensationalistic phrases and terms, not for the sake of being sensational. I think it's critically important for people in any alternative arena to be as clear and factual and emotionally neutral, not lacking passion, of course, but emotionally neutral, to avoid being dismissed for lack of any of those things. But
Alan,
I find myself
you've always been so conservative.
I find
that over the past year you've slowly moved closer to saying what there actually could be a conspiracy, or this could be true. It's impossible. So when it questions your belief system, and you're somebody who's really a very solid, grounded person, then what about other people? How do the rest of the populations view this type of information that appears totally unfathomable, unbelievable? So,
well,
you know, after you make a comment, I might want to moderate a little bit more of the show.
Sure. And I do want to get back and talk about the AVN more specifically and directly.
Yes.
But Meryl, you're just a wealth of information, and it's just a delight to have you here sharing it with us. But
Thank you. Just to finish
that thought, I have found myself resorting to terms like evil, because I just don't know what else to call it, because I see so much evidence and growing body of evidence over time of people who clearly know what they're doing and clearly are causing unnecessary harm and clearly are profiting exorbitantly from that and yet not being held accountable for it. And where's the accountability? So that brings me back to a question, Meryl, that I had a few minutes ago that I want to ask real quickly. Here in the U.S., I feel like a key part of how we can respond to all of this is to try to become legislatively active, because the law is certainly not the starting and ending point. But here in the U.S., I feel like it's a critical starting point. Where the rubber meets the road is where the law says you have to be vaccinated or don't have to be vaccinated, or have to be vaccinated but can have an exemption, but it has to fit this criteria or that criteria. And, you know, that's a different legal structure than what you have in Australia, but I feel like it's critically important for people here in the U.S. to be legislatively involved so that we can change the laws. That's a very tall order, but nonetheless, I feel like it's a critical piece. Is that something in any general or specific way that you feel would be applicable in Australia? Because, you know, the question that comes up when people reach a point where they recognize there is a problem, even if they aren't in total agreement with everybody else about what the problem is or so forth, but when you recognize that there's a fundamental problem here, a fundamental issue, the question that comes up then is, well, what do we do about it? And clearly the awareness, the information, the science or questioning the science or finding out what really is and isn't the science, those are all critical starting places for recognizing that there's a problem. What's the solution? Is there a legislative initiative? Is that idea something that you think applies in Australia? Can people organize to try to change the laws or support changes in the laws? Or is there something else that people can do?
I think that it's not a one-off thing. It's not you fight for the laws and do nothing else. I think there have to be multiple avenues of activity. Now, yes, people can change the laws, and we saw that just in Vermont recently where people became activists and the government was trying to get rid of the conscientious objection or philosophical exemption, I think you call it there, and they were not able to because the government was not able to get rid of it because of lobbying that was done by parents' groups in the state. One thing I just love about watching what's happening in the United States, once compulsory vaccination comes in, it's next to impossible to get rid of it. But Americans are so much more active and aware, I think, than Australians are. I don't know why this is the case, but the Australian culture is much more, there's a saying in Australia, she'll be right, which basically means everything's going to be okay. And that's the attitude of many things, you know, no matter what happens, she'll be right. And it's very hard to get people activated to realize that she won't be. You know, that you have to do something. we have a conscientious exemption clause in Australia, not for school entry, but for government payments, because the AVN lobbied Parliament back in the late 1990s. We found out that vaccination was going to be required in order to get certain payments, and we got a group of mothers together. We found out about this on a Thursday, and we flew down to Canberra. We raised $2,000 over the weekend to pay for our airfares and accommodation. We flew to Canberra. We spent almost 2 weeks lobbying federal parliament, and we got conscientious exemption legislation put into the federal act, which is still there today. So it's really important that people know they have power. If you live in a democracy, you are so lucky because you have some privileges that people who live in totalitarian or communist countries don't have, but along with those privileges is a responsibility. I think it's shocking that Americans don't vote. In Australia, voting is compulsory, and that's the one thing I think that should be compulsory. But it should also be compulsory, not compulsory, but people have to realize that if they are not happy with the situation in the government, they need to do something to change it. If you're not going to be part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So, you know, yes, by all means, it's very important to try and change legislation. And I wish the Supreme Court would rule on the compulsory vaccination. It's hard to imagine that a country that prides itself on freedom actually took away the right for parents to make health choices for their children. I don't think people really realize how incredibly restrictive that is and how dangerous it is for some families. Because whether you believe vaccinations are right, wrong, good, bad, or indifferent, vaccinations are not safe for every single person. And no government has the right to say that your child must be a sacrifice, a victim, for the greater good. There is no greater good. There's the individual. And as a mother, as a father, you owe your child a good start in life, and you owe it to them to make an informed decision. And if your information says that in your case, the vaccination, the risk of vaccination is greater than the benefit, then you have a responsibility to not take that risk with your child. And if the government is saying that you have to take that risk, that's a real problem.
Are you saying in Australia it is absolutely mandatory? Have they taken the right away from parents?
No, I'm talking about the U.S.
Oh, you're talking about
the U.S. Yeah, but in Australia, financial penalties are linked with vaccination, and that's why we've got our conscientious objection clause that we lobbied for. That says that even if you don't vaccinate, the government cannot withhold any payments from you. Yeah, our situation's a bit different than it is in the U.S.
Is your foundation, the AVN, Australian Vaccination Network, is this functioning similarly to the NVIC, the National Vaccination Information Network? Is it similar?
I think it's very similar, and we do, network an awful lot. Barbara Lowe Fisher and the NVIC and many of the other groups in the U.S., we network together, sharing information and support. We are a nonprofit organization. We've been a charity since 1996. We had our charity authority taken away from us. Now, I think it's the same as being a charity in the United States. You have to get approval from the government. And what happened is there's an organization called the Australian Skeptics. They have a very similar group in the United States, I think, called Quackbusters. And these people call themselves skeptics, and yet they're not skeptical at all. The only thing they're skeptical about is anything that is not mainstream. And they think that they kind of consider themselves to be the protector of Western medicine. So any organization that might question Western medicine is an enemy. And they set out 3 years ago, they set up a subgroup called Stop the AVN, and their goal was to shut our organization down. And they've done that by harassment, threats of violence, and filing many, many complaints against us with government bodies. And the government bodies, in some cases, have cooperated fully, because, as you can imagine, the AVN is not exactly flavor of the month with the government. And one of these organizations, the Healthcare Complaints Commission, which was set up specifically to protect the population from dangerous doctors, but instead they have turned out to be protectors of the doctors against the population, they investigated us for 12 months, and they ordered us to put something on our website to say that our information was solely anti-vaccination and people should not listen to us for medical advice. Now, we already had something on our website to say that we don't give medical advice, but we don't consider ourselves to be anti-vaccine. We consider ourselves to be a vaccine safety watchdog that's involved with helping parents protect their right to informed choice. So we refused to use their wording, and as a result of that, they issued a public warning, and our charity authority was taken away from us, which meant that we couldn't accept new members and we couldn't accept donations from the general public. And as you can imagine, we're a membership and donation-driven organization.
So if somebody wants to give you a donation, they're not allowed to, or how does that work?
They weren't allowed to for 2 years. We took the Healthcare Complaints Commission to the Supreme Court, and we won our case on the 24th of February. And the Supreme Court said that the HCCC, the Healthcare Complaints Commission, did not have jurisdiction to investigate us and that they had acted illegally in issuing a warning against us. And because that warning was overturned, our charity authority was reinstated. So on the 18th of April, we were once again able to take donations and new members. But, you know, as you can imagine, we've been unable to do that for 2 years. I had two part-time office staff. I had to let all of them go a couple of years ago. But, you know, this organization, Stop the AVN, since we won our case, we've had four more government investigations. So since the 24th of February, there have been four more government investigations of the Australian Vaccination Network. There is a very strong push to try and shut us down because the government considers what we say to be against government policy. It's a political decision, not a health decision. They don't basically want parents to be able to access information on the other side of the vaccination issue. I guess a compliant health consumer is in the best interest of the government, not a health consumer that's asking questions.
So if somebody wants to give a donation, they are allowed, they can do
they
that
now?
They are
now, yes.
They're allowed
to make a donation,
okay.
And they can join as a member as well. And, you know, memberships include the magazine Living Wisdom. So,
is that anybody around the world can join or only Australians?
No, anyone anywhere in the world. And as you can imagine, the magazine can be a bit expensive to ship, but we have a digital subscription, so the magazine is delivered online.
Okay. Why don't we give out your website again? So for those folks who want to learn more, who want to touch base with Meryl Dorey, the founder and spokesperson of the Australian Vaccination Network, that is www.avn.org.au. And you can go there anytime. You can join up. You can donate. You can help support rights and freedoms in Australia, because what happens in one place of the world could happen in your place. And you will be able to get the Living Wisdom magazine. That's www.living-wisdom.com. Okay, I don't want to stop you from telling us all you can. We have about 35 minutes left to the show, and you were speaking about the ability of your network to now be receive donations and be a charity organization.
Well, I wanted just to interject real quick a comment, if I may, Meryl. First of all, of course, we're deeply distressed that you're having to deal with that kind of nonsense when really your goal and focus is to support people and help educate people, and maybe you could elaborate a little more on what you do and how you do it. But I just want to say that, you know, there's looking for the glass is half full aspect of all of this. You must be really effective at what you do, or they wouldn't be spending their time attacking you. So let's wear it as a badge of honor to the extent that we can, because it's really an acknowledgement. You're a threat to the status quo, and in this case, one a threat that is, as you and I know, substantially warranted. And so may you continue to keep doing whatever it is you're doing, and hopefully not get distracted by, you know, more legal issues and so forth. But at least to the extent that means you're making a difference in raising awareness, congratulations. And please continue.
It must also cost quite a bit to hire legal aid to get through all of these lawsuits and these threats and whatever else is happening to you. So, tell us about that.
Well, our members were incredibly supportive. Because we were not allowed to take new members or donations from the general public, we were allowed to take donations from our current members. So at the time that we lost our charity authority, anyone who was a member was able to donate, but if you weren't already a member, you couldn't. And we could never have done any of this without our membership. But we also had a barrister who was acting pro bono, which meant that he wasn't charging us anything. If we hadn't had that, we could never have done it. But it still cost us over $25,000 to take this case and the case to get our charity authority back. And we had costs awarded by the court, and I'm not sure if it's the same in the United States, but even when you get costs awarded, it doesn't mean you get everything back. We only got a percentage back, but whatever it was good. It also proved a point. It set a precedent. The government will not be so quick to issue warnings or sanctions against community groups in the future, I believe, because it costs them a lot of money to do this, and they realize that they are going to be held accountable if something like this happens again. So hopefully what our action in taking this court case has actually made it easier for other organizations in Australia to be able to feel that they can have the freedom to express themselves and the freedom to carry on with their job. Volunteer organizations, for goodness sake, we should be allowed to do what we're doing. And when you spoke about the National Vaccine Information Center, when we won our case, I was contacted by the NVIC, and they said that the precedent that we had set in Australia could actually end up making a difference in the United States as well. And I'm hoping that's the case, because the world has gotten a lot smaller, and even though the legal systems are quite different, the principles are very similar. So hopefully what we've done will strike a blow for freedom and for the right to express ourselves and freedom of speech and freedom of communication, which were the principles at question there.
Okay, so do you want to continue on and tell us about the September 2009 complaint or move forward with more recent information?
Well, I think I'd rather, I mean, I've pretty well covered the fact that we're still under attack and that this organization, Stop the AVN and the Australian Skeptics, we believe that a lot of the people involved with these organizations are closely linked with pharmaceutical companies. We know that many of the people who are instrumental in these groups are doctors, but it's the same everywhere. It's the same in the United States. It's the same in Europe. And like Alan said, the reason that these people have gotten so active is because, and I really believe this strongly, Western medicine is on its last legs. People are becoming aware of their options. They're realizing that they have more choices, and they're also realizing that they're very, you know, there's an awful lot of sickness in the world today that is being caused by medicine. So instead of curing or treating, it's actually making people sicker and making them require more treatment. So I think that this is a desperate act of a desperate industry, which is the pharmaceutical industry, that is going downhill. And perhaps we're giving it that little push to make it slide downhill a little faster. I'm hoping that that's the case. But I really think that the most important thing for parents to be aware of, whether they're in the United States or in Australia, and not just parents, because vaccines are targeting everyone, every man and his dog, literally, is to know more information about vaccination and to know that they are able to access the information and to understand it. There's an awful lot of issues happening. I don't know if you in the United States heard about the situation with the swine flu vaccine in Australia, where hundreds of children were hospitalized.
Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, sure. We definitely were watching that here, though, in the alternative community. And I believe we've talked about that here on the Homeopathy World Community Radio Show as well.
Right, but many new listeners may not be aware. So
absolutely.
Let her
please
tell us.
Please refresh our memories on that.
Yeah, no worries. Well, In the United States, you've been using flu vaccines for children for about 10 years, but we never used the flu vaccine for children. And when the swine flu pandemic, so-called pandemic, was happening, the government out here said that there was a new vaccine that had been tested and shown to be perfectly safe and effective. And they actually wrote to parents who had children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years of age, saying to them, we are giving you this vaccine for free. Please get it for your children. And what happened was hundreds of children were hospitalized with seizures. And at least one of them has died, and one of them is permanently brain damaged. And it became quite a scandal because the doctors were not reporting the reactions. Doctors were holding up the reports. Some doctors were getting 12, 13, 14 reactions reported to them, but it was too much trouble for them to actually fill in the forms. They waited until they had enough reactions to actually make it worth their while, and then they'd fill in the forms and report the reaction. And because of this, the government was not aware of these reactions until after so many children had been injured. And there was an inquiry into it, and the vaccine was withdrawn for children. So no child under the age of 5 was allowed to use this vaccine. And just a few weeks ago in Australia, it emerged that doctors were still administering this vaccine from 2009, which is now well past its use-by date, to children under the age of 5. And at least one child has been put into intensive care with a reaction to this vaccine. And aside from the fact that the doctors were irresponsible and grossly negligent in doing this, and the government has said that they're not going to be held responsible for it, the government's already said that no doctor will be prosecuted for giving the wrong vaccine to children, which is so wrong. It is a prime example of why parents need to take the initiative and know what they're actually doing when they're getting their children vaccinated. If the parent who is getting a flu vaccine for their child, and, you know, parents are entitled to get their children vaccinated if they want to, but they need to be smart about it. If a parent was getting a flu vaccine for their child, they should have looked at the box. They would have seen on the box the use-by date was 2 years ago. That was number one. And they would have seen the name FluVax, and they would have realized, if they were aware, that FluVax is not to be given to any child under the age of 5. So parents need to take responsibility. They can't just say, well, the doctor knows best and he or she is doing this and they wouldn't do anything to hurt my child, because unfortunately a lot of doctors are not as aware of what they're doing as they should be. So it then falls to the parent to make sure that they are aware.
Wow.
Meryl,
I am really in shock about this, because I would say that if I was a young parent sitting in the doctor's office and my little child was up on the table, that the nurse would come in with the vaccine already prepared. You wouldn't even see the box. And unless you had heard you speak or somebody else educate that young person about the whole process of vaccination, they would have no concept whatsoever of any risk involved. And therefore, getting this word out is so very important. It's almost the same as reading the label on our food products today, that you have to take responsibility. This puts such a great onus on young people and just anybody to know what you're putting into your body, whether by mouth or any other way, in today's world. And it's quite a major undertaking and maybe even frightening.
Yes, it is. But look at it this way. If you were going to go out tomorrow and buy a car, and, you know, whatever it is, $15,000, $20,000 that you're going to spend on a car, would you just walk into the first car yard or car shop that you came to and say, I have $20,000, sell me a car? I mean, people would think you were crazy to do that. You would buy copies of Consumer Reports. You would test drive cars. You would speak with all your friends and neighbors. You would speak with your mechanic, you know. You would say, what's the best car for me? And you would spend some time and effort and money to actually become informed, because before you spend that money, you want to make sure that you're making a good investment. You don't want a lemon. Well, why would parents not put the same amount of effort into what they're going to do for their child's health? Why would they not read information, ask questions, get a second opinion, you know, become as informed as they possibly could be before making that decision? Surely the health of your child is every bit as important. It's much more important than your money. So, you know, I think that we have to accept that we need to take responsibility, and that means doing work, maybe spending a little bit of money, but definitely doing the work and becoming aware of what the issues are. How do you even know what questions to ask if you don't know that there are questions in the first place?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And
people don't. Parents, I think, and probably the people in general, don't regard health as healthcare as an industry. I mean, of course, we know it is, and yet we don't interact with our healthcare professionals at all, as you're pointing out, in the same way that we do other products and services that we recognize and treat as a business. But somehow, healthcare and the healthcare industry has managed to position itself in terms of our relationship to it and our perception of it. And it's so ironic because it's probably the most expensive products and services that we buy. Most Americans is probably healthcare, maybe with the exception of a home or an expensive car. But for many people, it's one of, if not the most expensive product service that we buy in our lives, and yet we don't regard it at all the same way. How has that come about? How have we allowed that to come about? Well, we don't have, you know, we can't challenge a doctor. We haven't been to medical school. We don't know all that. They're the experts. And it goes back to that same mentality of, oh, that's somehow beyond us, so we just have to take the word of someone else. Well, of course we should consult with experts in anything, just as you point out in your example with a car. Excellent analogy, I think.
I don't know that I'm going to agree with the car analogy exactly.
Well, the point is that there's research, that there are people we can consult with. You know, people make decisions with one degree or another of informedness or lack thereof. And the thing that is, you know, some people would go to all those efforts that Meryl said with a car. Others wouldn't go as far. But the point is that we don't recognize, we don't relate to healthcare as a product and service that's a for-profit industry that has its own self-interest, just like the car dealer or anyone else. And the question is, you know, you might consult a doctor as part of your information gathering, but what's clear and obvious to people in the alternative vaccine community is that, well, perhaps that's part of information gathering that clearly is not enough in and of itself. And I think underneath this, as we've been talking about intermittently in today's show, is our relationship to healthcare, our relationship to doctors, our relationship to the pharmaceutical industry. Somehow we've allowed that to be put beyond us, and we've accepted that in our own complete disempowerment. And when you talk about democracy as having opportunities but also responsibilities, Meryl, the word that comes to mind to me that I want to add to those two is the word vulnerability. We think we're in a free country, so this, that, and the other can't happen to us. And yet, ironically, by being in a quote-unquote free society, and there are people who would debate whether that word even applies or to what extent it applies, but for purposes of this point, in our free society, we have some unique vulnerabilities as well. And case in point, that industry can and has, not just in the healthcare arena, but in other areas as well, exercised growing influence over government and therefore over all of the people. Ironically, perhaps because of the unique vulnerabilities to us and opportunities for them to do that within the so-called free society. Would you agree with that?
Very much so. You know, people tend to think of pharmaceutical companies as if they were, charitable institutions. They're you know, doing such great work. They're making us better. They're making all these medicines and drugs. pharmaceutical companies are corporations, and corporations have two roles. Well, they have a role to make a profit for their board of directors and make a profit for their shareholders. There is nothing that makes a drug company inherently any more ethical than a tobacco company. They are there to make a profit, and we need to be aware of that. They're not there to be, charitable. They're not there to make the world a better place to live in. It's up to us to make the decisions. For me personally, once I started to look at this issue, and it becomes a journey. I don't know if you found it with yourself. I was so incredibly mainstream, when I got married and when I started having children, the doctors were the gods. That's how I'd been raised, and you just listened to anything the doctor said. And then when I had my son have his reaction, I started to question. I started to research. And eventually I reached a point where we don't see doctors anymore. Our healthcare practitioner is a chiropractor and a homeopath. So, we have made this choice to just basically turn our back on Western medicine, except if there's a broken bone or a car accident. I found that Western medicine is great for acute conditions, but not really for anything chronic or ongoing. Plus, for me, I'd rather have medicine that keeps me healthy rather than treats me when I get sick. But that's just me personally. But it does become a journey, and you do have to be constantly looking and reading and becoming aware. And a lot of people just don't feel that they want to do that. And I guess they have to understand that if that's the case, then they are putting their lives and their children's lives in someone else's hands and not taking responsibility for what they're doing. That may sound harsh, but that's how I really feel.
Well, it's hard, as I said before, it's hard for many of us to believe that because we wouldn't deliberately do something causing harm to others, it's hard to believe that there are other people who would, certainly not educated, upstanding people who run, huge corporations, pharmaceutical industry, and so forth. But let me put that myth to rest real quick here. Here in the U.S., anyway, the pharmaceutical industry is assessed literally billions with a B of dollars in fines, criminal and civil fines, every year. We just had GlaxoSmithKline was just assessed a $3 billion criminal civil fine. They last information I had, and this was right at the end of last year, they hadn't yet delineated that as to what portion of that was going to be called criminal and what portion civil. But I want to underscore the fact that you don't get assessed a criminal fine unless you did something that was criminal. And by definition, here in the U.S., that means you knew what you were doing and you did it anyway. And we had a situation in 2009 where Pfizer was assessed a $1 billion criminal fine along with a $1.3 billion civil fine. The criminal fine was as high as it was, in part because it was the fourth time that Pfizer had been caught doing the same thing, the same criminal behavior since 2002. Now, if you're going to repeat criminal activity, and fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars are common in this industry here in the U.S., they have actually outpaced the Department of Defense in terms of I forget the name of the act. It's a fraud act. The military here, this is an organization that you may recall hearing stories in the past that would pay $500 for a hammer and that sort of thing. People just helping themselves to government money in deliberately and blatantly fraudulent ways because they could. And because they were of a moral or ethical bent that would allow them to do that, there's a certain aspect of humanity or being human, and maybe it doesn't apply to all of us, but certainly collectively, that many of us who, given an opportunity to reach for the cookie jar, many of us will do that regardless of whose cookies were taken. Okay, that's a crude analogy, but the point is there are people who not only are there people who will behave criminally, who run pharmaceutical companies, but they'll do this repeatedly over and over again. We have to presume that there's a net profit in them for doing it. And in fact, Glaxo, with this $3 billion criminal civil fine, they had actually set aside $3.5 billion. So they came out a half a billion dollars ahead of what they were prepared for here.
Why is it that they're allowed to do this without someone going to prison? I mean, are you going to, if you murder someone, are you going to be fined for it? Or are you going to go to prison? And what the drug companies do lead to death and permanent disability. Surely, if they're doing it knowingly, as they did in the case of Vioxx and so many other drugs, why isn't someone going to prison? It's wrong.
Certainly, if that occurred, it would have a strong ripple effect throughout the industry. Exactly what the effect would be is anybody's guess, I suppose. But I agree with you absolutely. As far as I know, no one has ever gone to prison in these kind of situations. I did hear of a case several months ago where they were going to be prosecuting an individual, and I never heard any follow-up on that. So I don't know what the story is, but it would make a huge difference. But obviously, because we're talking literally billions of dollars in fines annually, this has been going on. I read an article, someone who had researched the numbers, and they said an average of about $1 billion a year over the last 20 years, but they said three-fourths of that had been in the last 5 years. That might be the last 6 or 7 years at this point, because I read the article several months ago. But the point is that it's just been getting worse and worse. And what does this say? It tells us, again, that there are people who know they're behaving unlawfully and in many instances criminally and in very big ways. And when you do that in the pharmaceutical industry, you hurt and kill people. I mean, it really, in one level, is as simple as that. And absolutely, people should be going to jail over that. I think, but the same,
can I ask Meryl a question?
Sure.
About to defend today's neighborhood physicians, could it be that they are just pawns in this whole scheme of things in the game of being fed information and having such an overload of work that they trust the information that's being handed to them, the medical pharmaceutical representatives giving them data and supplying them with drug samples and whatever, and telling them that they are really brainwashed into believing the herd immunity theory and stuff like that, and they're not questioning themselves, but they're just getting by. Is it fair to think of them that way?
Absolutely. I think that the average doctor working at the coalface really has no idea that this is happening. That's not an excuse, because if parents can find this information out, they can too. But they're not motivated to, because they believe strongly that what they're doing is the right thing, and they're not exposed to this information. When they are exposed to this information, they become like Larry Pilevsky, and they start speaking out about it. So it's really important that we get more doctors to be aware of this information. I actually attended a webinar this morning, Australian time, which would have been yesterday for you guys, from an organization called the IMCV. I forget what that stands for. Alan, do you know? International.
Don't recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't remember. But it was by an immunologist whose name is Tatiana. I cannot pronounce her last name. But she's written a book called Vaccine Illusion, which I highly recommend for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten halfway through the book just since this morning. And, you know, she's an immunologist, and she was right in the system, and it was only because she had a child herself and wanted to look into this that she started to. And she says that basically the whole issue of vaccination, vaccine-induced immunity, antibodies, is nothing more than a myth. But, you know,
right. And Kate Birch has also written numerous books. It's the International Medical Council on Vaccination, if anybody wants to look that up. So there's a Wisconsin chapter. I'm sure there's many other chapters. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. And one of the things that the IMCV does is they have a whole list of doctors, immunologists, pediatricians, all sorts of specialists in the medical field, neurologists, who are questioning vaccination. So there is one section of the medical community that wants to make it appear that there is one face for medicine and all of medicine approves the vaccine. But as long as we've been using vaccines, there have been vaccine questioners. There have been people who have been critical of vaccination, and many of those people come from the medical community. So when you say, does the average doctor working in the community know this information? No, they don't. I don't think the average person, I'm like Alan, I believe strongly that most people are good and motivated by the right reason, but they're simply not made aware of this information. When they go to medical school, they're not taught any of this, and everything that we're saying contravenes what they learned in school, and that's very hard to question something that is so basic to your entire 8 years of college education.
And it would be a shock to their system to think that they had been practicing in one way and doing harm, and they would have to take that guilt within them.
Well, and it goes even farther than that. In the medical community, there are very deliberate and strong disincentives. I have worked with, as clients, I've had healthcare professionals from all around the U.S., and every last one of them, down to the full count, no exceptions, just every one of them reports their work environment, and primarily this would be people in hospitals, that their work environment is a militant one for them as a healthcare professional. They are expected to do what they're told and shut up and not question or challenge anything. And I often have clients who say, you know, there's another five people in my department who don't want the vaccines either, but they're afraid to, you know, open their mouths or say anything or even ask for an exemption that they're legally entitled to because they're afraid they'll be singled out and fired. And, of course, you know, we're all familiar, I'm sure, in this listening audience to one degree or another with the Andrew Wakefield story. And here's a classic example. This is a guy who was not anti-vaccine whatsoever, just happened to make the mistake of suggesting in his 1998 study that more studies should be done to investigate the possible connection between vaccines and autism. And it cost him his entire career in what we all know now pretty clearly was just a witch hunt. But, you know, how many more people are going to publish a study that even mentions vaccines, let alone, in any sort of negative light, even potentially, with that as an example to follow? Now, interestingly and thankfully, there are studies that have come out since then that continue to raise questions about vaccines and autism, three just last year that I'm aware of. And so it hasn't shut the door entirely, but it is nonetheless very difficult for doctors to speak up raising any questions, let alone speak out against vaccination. It's a professional risk to them to do that.
And you just reminded me of something, Ellen. Time and time again, when there are studies done of doctors who work in hospitals to find out whether or not they're vaccinated against flu and the other vaccines that adults will take, the rates of vaccination amongst doctors is very low. It's usually about 25% to 30%. So maybe I'm giving them more credit than they actually deserve, because if they're not taking the vaccines themselves but pushing them on patients, then perhaps that means that they do know a bit more, but they're, as Alan said, afraid to do anything and say anything. And
it would be interesting to have an actual poll of physicians to find out what their reasons are, whether they're just lazy or whether they have a real motivation not to take it, or for one reason or another. It would be very fascinating to get some facts behind that.
Well, we had some polls during the pandemic about how many healthcare professionals wanted to get the swine flu vaccine, and there were different numbers at different points and from different parts of the world. But I saw figures ranging from somewhere around 2/3 early on, and then the number dropped over time. And the polls came from, again, different parts of the world, but the numbers dropped as the pandemic played out in terms of the percentage who were favoring vaccination for the healthcare workers. And even the AMA and other medical organizations here in the U.S. came out with a position against mandating the swine flu vaccine for healthcare professionals. So
that would be a whole other topic for a show, because I consider that a one-time incident of an epidemic contagious disease as opposed to regular mandatory vaccinations that are given on a regular basis.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Debbie. There's a very clear distinction between a fast-tracked emergency vaccine and people's resistance. Because I had people, I heard this from different sources, but in one case, someone calling me directly, a mother from Washington State, saying, I don't have any problem with vaccines, but what the heck is going on with this swine flu, you know, vaccine? So there were a lot of people who didn't have issues with vaccines generally, but then who had concerns with regarding the swine flu vaccine. And that's a real interesting point. And yes, it can be for many people a big difference.
Well, I would like to give you a moment to say some last words, Meryl. It's been a joy to have you on and be able to speak with you. And then I will close the show with some regular information.
Thank you, Debbie. And thank you very much, both of you, for inviting me. I've had a good time. And I've really, I hope that some of the information that I've been giving out is of help. I just want to say that with the vaccination issue, it is a worldwide issue. Diseases, as they say, are only a plane ride away. Well, vaccinations are only one bit of legislation away. And when we allow the government to tell us how we must treat our children and how we must take care of our own health, we are on a slippery slope towards tyranny. And I think it is every person's responsibility to ensure that their rights are protected. And I hope that everyone listening to this in the United States will join one of their local vaccine safety support groups and become active to protect your rights. As I said, it being in a democracy is a privilege, but it also comes with a responsibility. So let's all work together. Whether you believe that vaccines are good or bad doesn't matter. Everyone must agree that everyone has to be able to have the right to make that choice for themselves, especially for minor children. So let's get active and let's make sure that we protect our rights.
Well, we very much appreciate having you on, and hopefully you will come on again sometime in the future. I hope some eyes have been opened wide, because this information is just not reaching everyone. We also have many other shows to invite you and any listeners to come in and go on the live chat, ask your questions, put in your comments, even call in and speak. Tomorrow morning, Dr. Adil Kasim from India will be talking about heart health and homeopathy, as he does every week. He is a wealth of information, and we have been studying the repertory, the book of knowledge, I should say, about the sensations and what are the symptoms that we have every day that tell us whether we are healthy or not healthy. On Thursday at 11 a.m., Dr. Christina Chambreau, a doctor of veterinary medicine, will be talking with us about pet behavior, and she also has spoken numerous times on the vaccination issues. And you said, take care of your pets. Literally, they are also dealing with vaccination side effect issues. And then we will be on again Thursday at noon. I will rebroadcast this show as much as I can, and probably do it more than once. On Monday evening, we have Grant Bentley coming on, I think next week, to talk about facial analysis and homeopathy. And of course, our new show, The Health In Show, which is a live video stream, is Monday at 11 a.m. Dr. Tony Bark will be talking about that whooping cough epidemic that is circling the globe. So I'm going to end the show. Alan, you want to say your goodbyes?
Meryl, thanks again for coming on. You're a wealth of information, and obviously a deeply compassionate person as well. It's such a pleasure and honor to have you, and I hope we can have you back again. I really look forward to that. Keep up the great work. You have our support here in the U.S., and of course we look to continue to be networking with you and having your support as well.
Thanks so much. I really
thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio.
Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be young girl. One.